The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And we are going back to one of our favorite places, South Island, New Zealand, the Otago region, owner of Wooing Tree Winery. It is Steve Farquharson. Steve, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Okay, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, absolutely. We ran into you just kind of by chance, and I want to talk about the winery and Wooing Tree and your portfolio. But let's just start here. What led to your love of wine, where you find yourself in London studying viticulture winemaking, you're getting your WSET diploma? Where did that all start?
Well, it didn't really start from a love of wine. Back then, my wife and I were living in the UK. We're actually living in Brighton. I did work a little bit in London, but Brighton down on the south coast. And we were both working in IT. We'd gone from New Zealand. I think we went for a 6 month contract and ended up staying for 6 years. So we were over there working away. And then we had our first son, actually. And we were thinking we wanted to come back to New Zealand. And we didn't really want to end up back in an office job in Auckland or something like that. And we just really wanted to come and live in central Otago. I don't know, a lot of people won't know, but it's a beautiful place, and it's, you know, has a lot of outdoor activities, skiing, snowboarding, water skiing. It's hot in the summer, cold in the winter. And really, we just wanted to come and live here. And we found out, we thought, oh, we could buy some land. Actually, a friend's dad had some land for sale here, and we thought we could buy some land, build a house, something like that, and then we'd, get jobs down here, maybe set up a business or something. And we found out they were growing grapes here. So it really started off like that. So we just wanted to come home. We started looking online, for land and stuff. And then, it just steamrolled from there. And I did go and study. I didn't really know anything about wine then. I drank a little bit. And to be honest, I don't think I knew the difference between Pinot Noir and a Sauvignon Blanc. And so it was a very steep learning curve, but a lot of fun.
So hold on. This is maybe the most unique wine origin story I've heard. You started to make wine because you wanted to come home. You loved the environment. You wanted to bring your son. You wanted to get out of IT. And it just made sense. This wasn't, you weren't inspired by a trip to Burgundy. You were just inspired for a different lifestyle.
No, that's 100% right. Yeah, not the normal want to have a winery kind of story. No, it was, we just wanted to come and live here. And we bought the land. I think I was working for IBM, Lloyd's Bank, IBM at Lloyd's Bank. And I Googled wine schools and I didn't even know that there was wine being grown in the UK, to be honest. And there was actually a wine school just outside of Brighton called Plumpton College. So the next day I went out and visited the college and met the head professor there. And I was the next day I was resigning from my job and I was studying full time doing a wine degree.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have to ask, what was the reaction of friends and family when you told, because it's not like they knew that you'd been collecting bottles for ages and that you loved viticulture. What happened when you told friends and family, I've quit my IT job, which I imagine was pretty steady, and we're now going to go make wine?
I think they were pretty excited, a little bit jealous even, kind of thought it was pretty cool. A lot of our friends were from New Zealand, so, they understood that we were wanting to go home and, wanted to live, on the land, do something outside and we were into snowboarding and stuff and those kind of activities at the time. So mountain biking and all that sort of stuff. So I think they understood that. And a lot of our mates from the UK or, different people that were over there, I think they thought it was pretty cool. We took them on the journey, that's for sure. The name, and I started, I very quickly I was immersed in the wine. My first day at college, most of the other students were sommeliers or journalists or, things like that. And, they assumed because I was a Kiwi, I knew everything about Sauvignon Blanc. And I remember sitting in the class, they were looking at me for advice, and I knew absolutely nothing. But obviously a lot of practice, a lot of tasting and a lot of fun. And, the course was very, very practical. They had, it was kind of an amazing place to be doing wine because you don't think about it. But, the wine trade, London, was right there. And a lot of people in my course were from the trade, sommeliers and journalists and things like that. They had each student in the first year was mainly focused around vineyards. So we had 500 vines each to look after, which was quite a lot, so we could play around with them, try stuff. And then, obviously the second year was more focused on the winemaking, and they had quite a little tiny winery that we could try stuff. And it was, and there was kind of a commercial winery as well, because they sold a lot of the college's wine at the local markets and things like that. So, yeah, it was a great course. And probably the main thing, I met a lot of really good contacts in the trade, knowing nothing about wine. And one of the other things I did as part of that course, I had to do a project on a wine business. I ended up setting up a wine import business as part of that. And I imported wine from New Zealand back to the UK, and set up a little portfolio. And I went around, trying to sell wine in London and, the whole of the UK, actually. So that was a huge steep learning curve, because that back in 2002, New Zealand wine wasn't that well known at all in the UK, and certainly not Central Otago. And I can remember going, and there's a lot of stuffy old wine sort of businesses, and I was dealing with people in Pinot Noir. They didn't know anything about Pinot Noir. All they knew about was Burgundy and Bordeaux, and I was trying to talk about Central Otago, this new region that no one had ever heard. So it was a really steep learning curve, but it was probably the thing that really got me going, helping us before we came back, set us up along the path of how hard it is to sell wine.
All right, I've got two more questions about your wine origin stories that I did not even think about, but we will get to Wooing Tree. By the way, anyone, if you're in Cromwell, if you're visiting that area in Otago, go visit. It's a really nice spot. How welcoming were the students with you? Because you're you're the new person, the outsider. Wine can sometimes be a bit of an insular, depending where you are in the world, a little world. So what was that like?
No, they were. A lot of them. They were really went along on the journey as well, because we were buying land, setting up a vineyard remotely. So they were pretty excited about it. There was about three others in my class that were doing something similar in France or Italy and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So one guy was setting up a vineyard in the UK as well. So yeah, I think they all went along on the journey as well and were very supportive. Yeah. And I think the main thing, like I said, was getting involved in the wine trade. We'd go on class, school trips up to London and, doing the WCT tastings and all that and judging wine. We went on class trips to Burgundy, Bordeaux, Montpellier, those kind of things you can't really do from New Zealand either, So, doing the tastings, it was basically once a week we would get together and do these fun tastings that would always end up at the local pub or something later on. So it was great fun.
That sounds awesome, especially school trips to Burgundy. Much better than my school trips. And then last one here, but this is sort of a New Zealand wine question. How much easier is it to sell Otago, Central Otago Pinot Noir to London in 2026 versus during those early days for you? I guess it's a long-winded way of asking how further along is New Zealand in terms of recognition for making high-end quality Pinot that can compete with Burgundy?
Yeah, well, I think it happened a lot faster than 2026. I mean, 2004, I remember, I still had a good relationship, even though we came back to New Zealand and were setting up our vineyard and we started working on it and doing everything in New Zealand. Because I had good links back to the UK and I had that import company that I'd set up, I was going back once a year to the UK and continued selling. I've now got a distributor who does it for me. I don't do that now. But yeah, in 2004 even, it was a big change. Central Otago was starting to become known. Some of the wine writers and things were talking about Central Otago. The local, I got involved in the local Central Otago wine growers marketing group, and we did a lot of hard work in the early days, promoting Central Otago rather than, just our brands. And we were, most of us were all very new. There was a few pioneers back in the 90s, late 90s and stuff, that did, that started off, but then probably around about our time, there was like the second wave of a lot of new plantings and a lot of new producers. So we did get on the marketing trail and started promoting Central Otago. I went back to London with the group. We would do stuff all around the world. So, and Central Otago was starting to make a really good name. And nowadays you'll go into most top restaurants in the world and you'll probably see a Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc and a Central Otago Pinot on the list. So yeah, things have changed significantly.
Oh, yeah. It's you can go anywhere now, even Canada, and there's going to be tons of your wine. So I love this quote. Now, going back to all things Wooing Tree, You said, we purchased the land while living overseas, so we didn't know anything about the wooing tree. How much faith did you have then in the land, in the people that were scouting this property for you guys?
Yeah, so when we did this all remotely, we did come back to New Zealand, had a look. We Googled wine consultants, I guess, or something like that. Yeah, literally, we knew nothing about growing grapes. And we ended up getting a hold of Robin Dicey, who was the owner of Mount Difficulty Wines. And also, he was instrumental in setting up a lot of vineyards in central Otago. He was a viticulturist. That was his main thing. And so we just got a hold of him. And then very quickly, he was helping us look for bits of land. I think back in the, you know, we had this idea we wanted to live in the country, you know, living, coming from Brighton or living, you know, working in London and stuff like that. So we had this dream to come back and, you know, not be in a town and working on the land, really. And we looked at different bits of land, and then we had this thing where I think we wanted to be on a, you know, like on a slope. We needed a, you know, for frost protection, you know, draining and all that. We ended up with a flat bit of vineyard and very close to the town. So this land had been derelict for 100 years. No one had done anything on it. It was right beside the town. And it you know, didn't quite seem like what we were looking for, but you know, what happened was, also at the time there was huge demand for grapevines, and we had to pay for our grapevines before we actually got them. So I can remember we paid for them, and then we didn't have any land, so we were getting a little bit panicky. So anyway, Robin was finding bits of land for us, and then there's a lot of you know, things, you know, to do with water and all these sort of things. They had to all tie up to make it all work. Anyway, we bought this bit of land in town, and then he sent us an email saying that there's all these trees on the vineyard that need to come down. And we were like, yeah, okay, that's fine. We had seen the land. We'd come back and seen it. And then he sent us an email saying there's this tree on the land called the Wooing Tree, that it's the old Lover's Lane of Cromwell. People used to woo or make out under the tree, and even half of Cromwell was conceived under the tree. So that the wooing tree was quite famous. And we were obviously trying to come up with a name for our brand as well. And we thought, oh, that seems like the obvious name, good name, you know. And so we actually talked to our friends and we put it out there to see what everybody think. And you know, most people thought it was a pretty cool name. So we said to Robin, surely we can keep the tree. And we didn't know, but back here in Cromwell, there was a poetry competition to save the tree. It was on TV. It was in the newspaper, on the radio, this campaign to save this famous tree. And, you know, that we were the evil owners from overseas that were chopping down this history. So anyway, we kept the tree, and now it's our brand. And we've done a lot more with it. You know, people propose under it. We've done weddings under the tree. And that's a great story.
Yeah, it is. I love that story. How long did it take for you to woo the town of Cromwell that you guys were not evil, rich industrialists from London looking to destroy their environment?
Yeah, I think, it was obviously highly visible, because if you come here and notice, you'll see our vineyard was right in the middle of town.
Yes.
And obviously, I think people, they embraced it, liked it. Yeah, it's funny because we had to actually do a consent with the council to turn the land from rural residential back into a vineyard. So we had a, you know, like it was literally on the outskirts of town. So I think people did like it. They watched it, you know, get ripped up, you know, the trees come down and the vines being planted. And it takes 3 years to set up a vineyard and get it to producing. So we stayed over in the UK, living and working over there. Thea, my wife, carried on working, and I was studying, and I was doing that wine distribution thing. So we did that for another 3 years before we came back for our first vintage.
And people should know, also going back to it, Robin Dicey, Mount Difficulty is one of the more well-known, important wineries in New Zealand. What did he see in that land that, you know, he's like, this piece of property would be very amenable to making quality wine, making quality Pinot Noir?
Yeah, well, I don't know if he really thought it was any different to any other bits of land. I mean, remember I did say we were looking for something on the slope for the frost
protection.
Yeah,
you didn't get that.
No, it's ended up on the flat. But in the long term, it made it really easy to manage, being on the flat. And I think back then, a lot of vineyards, a lot of people didn't realize that even vineyards on the hill still get frosted. So, a lot of these are supposedly frost-free sites ended up not being frost-free at all. So, there's a lot more frost protection systems had to go in. So, right from the start, we had to fight frosts. We had to put in a system, and it's got us through all those years. So yeah, and I think Central Otago, I mean, the soils here are very light and wind blown sand, most of the soils, the whole of the Cromwell Basin. But I put a lot more weight on the climate, really, to be honest. The hot days, cold nights, build up the fruit flavors, retain the acidity. We have long nights, a lot of sun. The grapes are very short summer, but very hot and dry summer. So it's kind of perfect for growing Pinot Noir, really.
And also, yeah, people need to know, no matter how hot it is during the day, you're not going to get warm nights. When that sun sets, the temperature drops so quickly. It's one thing we noticed during our time in South Island. Let's talk a little bit about your portfolio. What do people need to know, from Blondies to Beetlejuice, to everything in between?
Yeah, well, we do 12 wines, and we do seven, I think, out of Pinot Noir. So we've got the a rosé, pink rosé. So back then, 2005, our first vintage, living in the UK, I knew that people drink red, white, and rosé. It was a big thing in the UK. And came back here, I remember making a rosé the first year, and a lot of the other producers were like, "Oh, what are you wasting good grapes on rosé?" I knew that it was back then, it was quite hard to sell rosé, to be honest. But now everybody makes a rosé pretty much, and it's so easy to sell. So we made the rosé, and then we in 2006 we opened our new tasting room. And we didn't have any white grapes. So I had this idea about making a white wine from Pinot Noir, and that's where the Blondie came in. So our winemaker at the time, Carol Bunn, I talked to her and I said, "Could we make this Blanc de Noir, white wine from Pinot, very blush rosé kind of thing?" And we did it. It was a bit of an experiment. We made it in 2006, and it's now pretty much a cult wine. Now it's sells out really fast, and we make more and more of it. And that's where the Blondie came into our portfolio, just because at the time we didn't have any white grapes. We do have Chardonnay and Gewürztraminer now, so we do have some proper whites. But yeah, that's where those two wines came in, and the Blondie is very, very popular. We do three Pinot Noirs. The Beetlejuice is our entry level Pinot. It's named after the Cromwell Schaefer beetle, which is a little beetle which is only found in Cromwell. And it's critically endangered, and there's actually a reserve set aside to protect it. So that's where the name Beetlejuice comes in. And then we have the Wurundjeri Pinot Noir, which is our flagship wine. That's the wine that we really want to sell, and most of our accolades and awards is for that wine over the years. And the Sandstorm Reserve, which is mainly just a step up from the Wurundjeri. The main thing we do is we sometimes select a part of the vineyard. We sometimes might chop up a bit extra fruit to build up concentration and flavours. Mostly we don't have to because we get quite low yields anyway. And then the other thing, it stays in oak for 6 months longer. So that's really where the Sandstorm Reserve comes in. And the name Sandstorm comes from the sandy soil. That's Cromwell Basin. It's pretty very, very sandy. Yeah, and then we have two bubbles now, Blondie and Co. That's basically Blondie with bubbles. So we've a lot of people, we do a lot of functions, weddings and stuff, and we always wanted a bubble. So now we have that. And we have one called 60-40, which is 60% Blondie and 40% Chardonnay. So that's our other one. And we have Gewürz, Chardonnay, Pinot Gris, and then we have two sweet wines. We have one called 1401, which is a Gewürztraminer, late harvest sweet wine. And we have one called Tickle Pink, which is a sweet rosé. So as far as I know, we're the first people in New Zealand to make a sweet rosé. So that's the portfolio. So we have a lot of wines, and a lot of wines made from Pinot Noir.
And I will say, I always talk about how you can tell a good winery is one where their entry level, whatever word you want to use, is well made. Your Beetlejuice, we loved it when we were there tasting it. So even your humblest, whatever adjective or verb you want to use, was a really good wine. So commend the work that's being done there. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your first vintage. What was life like for the two of you back then? And also, how important was it? Because you guys got a bunch of critical success early on. How important was that in terms of being able to sell your wine?
Yeah, so our first vintage, I mean, that was exciting. We had Robin helping us, but also, and some of our friends actually from the UK came back for our first vintage. Oh, and the US, so one of our friends that lived in the US came back, and they all helped out. They all wanted to be involved in this, new venture and our new life. and we were doing everything under Robin's guidance. I think I grew up on a farm, so things like driving the tractor and all that sort of stuff was not new to me. So, and that was part of what we wanted to do, you know, work on the land. Yeah, we picked our first vintage, we made the rosé, and then we made the Pinot Noir, the Whirring Tree Pinot Noir. Yeah, and the next year we were releasing it. We had this idea that it would be good to get a nice review, like a 3-star or something like that. There's a magazine in New Zealand called Cuisine, which rates, you know, food and wine. And we had this thing, you know, if you've got 3 stars in cuisine, that would be really good. We'd be able to put a sticker on our bottle. Actually, our first vintage, it got 5 stars in cuisine, and it was the second top Pinot, which was huge. And it won the Air New Zealand Trophy. So for the top red wine in New Zealand. So, and also that first year, we did win quite a few other gold medals and things like that. So to win that Air New Zealand Trophy, which was basically the Oscars of wine in New Zealand, was huge. And to be honest, I didn't really realise how important that was. I mean, we got distribution from overseas directly from that competition. You know, we sold wine quite. It was very easy to sell the wine that first year. It was our first vintage off Whirring Tree, so it was only a third. You know, so we didn't do huge volumes, but it was still. It did get us our name out there with around the wine trade and even around the world.
Well, that must have been so important. And as you said, you have a background in exporting, importing wine, in the wine business. And for especially a newer winery, it's the number one thing you need is it gives you this credibility, especially if someone doesn't know your wine or doesn't know the label. People get nervous buying wine. But if they see, oh, okay, it's one of these awards, if it was good enough for them, it's good enough for me to, you know, to buy a bottle.
Yeah, no, it certainly helped a lot. Yeah, and over the years, we've won a lot of trophies and things around the world. So we've continued to do pretty good with the accolades. So yeah, it's good recognition, but also helps with the sales. With the and the trade.
Yeah,
certainly helps a lot.
How important is your wife Thea to the whole story of Whirring Tree? Was she down for it right away, and just her importance to everything that you guys do?
Oh, totally. At the start, she was the same as me. We just wanted to come back and live in New Zealand and, you know, do the outdoorsy stuff. And, that was 100%. You know, same thing. She wasn't into wine. Yeah, you know, we used to drink wine a little bit, go out to restaurants and have the old bottle. But that was it, really. No, totally. She actually stayed working. So when I left my job and went to Plumpton College, she continued working. So she was very important from that point of view. We had our first son, so we were like juggling, you know, looking after him. She was working and I was studying full time and also was selling wine. So I can remember tottering around London with Finn in the backpack, selling wine, you know, when he's a little baby and things like that. So, you know, she was obviously very important. But behind the scenes, there's the rock and the glue and all that sort of stuff of our whole business. She's not so keen on being the front facing, you know, customer facing person of it. But no, she does the admin and the accounts and, I think usually I come up with the ideas and then she probably worries about what she, you know, how she's going to make it work, how we're going to do this. But yeah, incredibly important.
So you mentioned, you know, you guys were sort of into wine. You would have it, you know, order a bottle every now and then. Mm. How different is it now when you and Thea go out for dinner when it comes to your approach to the wine menu for a nice dinner in 2026 versus, say, 2006?
Well, I guess we do know brands and we do know different wine styles around the world. I mean, New Zealand's a little bit isolated from, you know, most of the wines you'll see in New Zealand are New Zealand or then Australian. And, you know, you might go to a fancy restaurant and they might have a few European kind of wines, but we're still pretty much drinking New Zealand wine most of the time. Thea's favourite wine is Chardonnay. So, I mean, if we go out for a restaurant, she'll definitely usually buy a Chardonnay, Hawke's Bay or something like that. Or Australian or something. So yeah, no, not a lot's changed, to be honest. I mean, most wine people aren't really wine snobs. You know, they just like drinking wine and like trying everything. So yeah, no, we just we're just very lucky that there's a lot of good wines around.
There is, especially on the Chardonnay side, from the Elephant Hill down all the way to Felton and everything in between, and your guys' stuff. Yeah, there's tons of great Chardonnay. So one thing I'm curious about is your expansion. And I remember you were telling us about this. All your vines moved from one location now to the Pink Moon Vineyards. I was wondering if you could just tell that tale.
So our vineyard was in the on the outskirts of town, and then the town slowly grew around us, and we ended up being in kind of in the middle of town. The land was becoming more valuable, and the town needed more land, so it became it was never our intention at the start, but it sort of like happened kind of faster than we ever thought, to be honest. And we decided that we would do a subdivision, turn the vineyard into basically houses sections. So that was started. We were actually the when COVID hit, that was when we were about to launch the project and do the marketing. So it was like, oh, and then we had to like just stop a little bit and have a think about this. Was this the right time? But it turned out to be the right time. And yeah, so we decided to do the subdivision. We bought and we're nearly finished now, actually. So part of that process, we had our old tasting room on the vineyard in town, and we always wanted to have a bigger and better tasting room on the highway, more closer to the town. So part of that process, we're able to build a new tasting room, and that's where I met you, which is more like a restaurant really as well. And that's right on the highway in the middle of town. So we were able to do that. We did the subdivision, but also a part of that we wanted to carry on with our wine business. We've worked so hard, a great brand, and we didn't really want to stop. So best of both worlds, we're able to buy some land up the road. 10 minutes up the road, they bought this vineyard. It was actually an established vineyard that was planted in 2002, so 1 year after our original Werringtree vineyard. But part of that land had a part of that vineyard had bare land, so half of it was planted and half of it wasn't. So we decided actually would shift the vines from the old vineyard, so 22-year-old vines, to the new vineyard. The actual main reason was back then there was a 5-year waiting list for baby vines, and then it takes 5 years to get a baby vine into full production. So we're talking 10 years. And so we did look at some bare land, looked at other vineyards for sale in Central Otago, but this, the one we bought, with that bare land and not being able to get the group vines from the nurseries, we decided to shift them, which was a bit of a risk. No one had, I'm sure no one has done it on that level before. The first year, well, the year before that, we shifted 500 vines because at the subdivision we've planted a buffer vineyard around the outside of it, which is actually a hectare and a half. So it is quite a significant vineyard, even though it looks quite small. But it is still, a proper working vineyard around the subdivision and beside our tasting room. So we shifted 500 vines, and they all survived. And then so we decided to carry on and do the big shift from here up to the Pink Moon Vineyard, and 20,000 vines. This year we got 70 tons off those 20,000, it's well worth it. We would be still looking at a bare bit of land. We'd be buying grapes from other vineyards to try and keep our brand going. So no, it was very successful. Interesting, when you talked about Robin Dicey, his son James is the viticulture now and that running that business. And James was the one that mainly helped with shifting those vines. James Dicey.
Yeah, that'd be a wild project. I'm wondering, could you tell any sort of stylistic difference in your wines, either in fruit profile, body, alcohol, anything? Even though you didn't move that far, you're still moving from one vineyard to another.
Yeah, well, actually, we shifted from very different soil. So the Werringtree Cromwell Basin is very sandy, windblown sand, basically just sand. And then the vineyard that we've purchased is quite loamy with clay on the back of it. And the front part of the vineyard is very kind of river stony, alluvial river stone. So very, very different soil. Talking about the style, and everybody asked that same question, what you just asked about the changes. Have we noticed anything? I haven't really much. It's very hard. The 2023 Beetlejuice is quite dark and dense. I'm trying to work out whether it's the soil or just the vintage, because we do have quite vintage variation in Central Otago. So no, I can't really answer that yet. I mean, maybe in a few years' time. So we have gone from I guess poor soil, which can be good for growing grapes anyway, to really good soil, which can be good. So yeah, I know we'll just have to watch the space. And yeah, and it's everybody asks that same question, and I can't really answer that quite yet.
It'll be fascinating, like doing like a tasting 5, 7 years down the road, just to see if there is anything, or blind tasting to see. Also, it's interesting about you guys is, where we went and we saw you at the tasting room in that place. It's so weird where you have this working winery and vineyards, and it's within this subdivision. And by the way, anyone listening in Toronto, very different subdivision, much more open, much more pastoral than subdivisions you get here outside of Toronto. But it was just interesting to see, you know, people's living space and the vineyards all sort of woven in together.
Yeah, I mean, literally, I'm looking straight out the window now, and there's vineyards across the road. So, yeah, even though we've created this subdivision in town, I mean, we're surrounded by country. So I didn't, you know, like 400 meters. Oh, there's a lake 400 meters away, and you know, so it's right on the it's still on the edge of town, really.
Trust me, if you're going to be a subdivision where you are, is not bad. Before we end this, what are your goals, your hopes for the next 5 years? I mean, it's a hell of a journey that you've already been on over the last 20. But what where would you like to see Wooing Tree the next 4 or 5 years?
Just continue, really, and try and consolidate. We've got this new tasting room, which is a big, bigger thing than we had in the past. You know, it's a restaurant. We need to make that work. And, you know, in Cromwell, we're a little bit away from Queenstown and Wanaka, which are the big tourist places in central Otago. And so in Cromwell, we really rely on the locals as well as the tourists. You know, like the serious wine tourists will come to Cromwell because, you know, you've got your other your vineyards, Felton Road and Mount Dee and all those, Carrick and all those kind of ones here. So they do come. But we're not quite as, you know, busy with tourists as Wanaka and Queenstown. So, but Cromwell is a growing place. You know, I think it's the fastest growing town in New Zealand. It's a small place, but it's growing really fast with other subdivisions and a lot of businesses coming in. So, yeah, no, we think we're in a good spot in Cromwell. There's a lot of potential. And, yeah, just continue, really. And, you know, like we've got two boys, whether they'll ever want to have anything to do with the wine. The oldest one actually has done a couple of vintages in central Otago, and he worked on our vineyard for a couple of years. So he is quite interested, but he's in London at the moment doing his OE. Overseas experience with what a lot of Kiwis do. So, yeah, he's talking about doing a vintage in England or France this year. So, yeah, I mean, there's the possibility he will want to be involved in it, I think. So we'll just, we'll see what happens.
It's got to follow his journey, but fingers crossed he comes back to the family business. Steve, really appreciate you being on. And again, congratulations to you and Thea, just for you had a dream. You went from one life to a completely other one. It's been, as far as I can see, it's been very successful. Me and my girlfriend Amy and her sister Christy, we loved it. So again, congrats on taking that jump and it paying off so far.
Oh, well, no, it's great. Now we want to continue and yeah, just make it better, really.
Thanks for being on the pod today.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.